Call to order. The House Revenue Committee. Welcome everybody here today. Apologize for the late start with the crowd in the gallery. It was hard to get through, but I'm glad to see we have a quorum and we're ready to go here this morning on school finance. Some more of our orientation. Paul, anything you want to remark as we lead into this?
One thing before I forget, Mr. Chair, is that you do have floor session tomorrow at 8:30. So
we'll come down here, Kathy. Are we having technical difficulties? Are we on or not? You know, just committee, we had a meeting, just to tell you, people really do listen to this. We had a meeting in Judiciary yesterday, and by the time I got back to my office, there was an email from somebody in Bend who who wanted to weigh in on a discussion we'd been having in the Judiciary Committee.
That's great.
It is great.
Well, somebody's been listening on the internet.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. I said, hey, great comments in the committee. Glad you were right there as soon as I got back to my office.
Wow.
So, watch your syntax. Watch your grammar.
You bet it wasn't somebody from Dallas, huh?
Yeah, that's right. We'll stand at ease while Kathy is getting the technical.
But you were going to tell us about the session tomorrow? Or?
Oh, well, yeah. Session is at 8:30 tomorrow morning. We will just—it's just going to be the same thing we've been doing. I think it's because Ramona has to be gone midday, and so just there's nothing special about it. We'll just convene here 5 minutes after we adjourn upstairs.
Okay.
I think all the morning committees will do that.
That's so you.
Before technology, they didn't have to worry about this.
Be writing it down.
But we wouldn't want to disappoint our public.
Oh, that's right. Who knows? Maybe
that
we're
that
on.
Is really who I am, you know?
But it is amazingly easy to listen to these committee sessions. And sometimes when there's one that's that I wanted to hear from another committee, I can log on and do it.
It's easy to find them archived, too.
Yes, so if you want that's to what I'm
yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mark, we're waiting under a T-minus 8 minutes and holding here.
I thought we were waiting for Mark.
Yeah.
Well, school finance.
Uh-huh.
We're going to solve that one today.
Are we ready? Okay. Well, now we're ready to go with our technical problems fixed, we hope. And for the record, in case anyone was listening on the internet and wanting to know how to catch us tomorrow, there's a House floor session at 8:30 tomorrow morning. This committee will meet 5 minutes after the close of the floor session. It's not going to be a long floor session, but we will not be starting here on our usual prompt 8:30 starting time. With that, now we have school finance. Steve, I don't think you've been before the committee yet. So this is Steve Myers, our school finance specialist. What else do you do, Steve?
That's all.
That's it? How many runs are we up to so far for this session?
None.
Steve does the school distribution formula runs that give us the numbers per district as we get into building the school formula and the K-12 distribution. And so every time somebody wants to amend the formula or every time the number changes up or down in gross, Steve gets to do a new run. And I don't know, what did we get up to last time? In the 80s?
Well, if you include the ESDs, it was in the 50s, 60s.
So lots of different runs of the school formula before we get done. Well, it's good to know we haven't started. We're not that far yet. Steve, welcome for our school finance overview. Kathy, if you'll bring the lights down.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. And let me explain the reason for not doing any runs yet is we're currently in the process of updating the data. So getting new data from the Department of Education. We're trying to postpone that for a little bit yet. This morning we want to talk about school finance, starting out with the big picture, and you'll have to help me out on the pace that you want to go. There's lots of slides here, we can go relatively fast or so, or however you want to proceed.
We're done at 10:30.
By any means. But they're there for the record, at least. What the approach this morning is to basically start out with some big picture slides, both on revenue and expenditures, and then look at the 01, 03 numbers briefly, such as they are, and then talk about primarily the K-12 equalization formula, then switch to the ESD phase-in of their new equalization process, look at a little bit on other funding sources, including local options, and then look at the numbers for the 03-05 budgets as they are in the governor's proposal. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the plan this morning. To start out with, just noting briefly what the money goes for, we're teaching currently about 550,000 students as the fall enrollment, with about 36,000 teachers and support teachers' aides, another support in the classroom, 12,000 support staff, and that's to run about 1,400 school sites in 198 school districts. So it is a big operation. The other side of the public is there's also private students that are not part of this funding process. The Department of Education used to ask for reports from the private schools as to how many students they've had. If they didn't hear from all the schools, there wasn't really a big effort to try to get a report from that school. So these numbers are very rough. And the Department of Education has stopped asking for that kind of information too, so that will go away. But roughly, you know, 50,000 on the private side that are not part of the cost for public schools. The resources, you can see how they've changed over this time period. This is audited data, and it's for all revenue, so it's a very broad picture. It's more than just the formula revenue. And it divides it up into the four main sources, intermediate, federal, state, and local. The local being primarily property taxes. There's also fees and charges and money that they cut for the lunch program and all of that besides. But if you look at that bottom bar for local, you can see that after Major 5 was fully phased in 95-96, that it started to increase in 96-97, and then it drops back down a little bit in 97-98 with the beginning of Major 50. So that's what's, and then gradually starts to increase after that. So that's that driver. Then you can see the state height of the bar increasing rather dramatically as that replaced the lost local revenue. With the state being primarily the state school fund and the common school fund here. Federal dollars, fairly stable, but increasing a little bit. That includes federal force payments, all of their grants for special education, school lunch program, et cetera. So all federal dollars. The intermediate ones are from ESDs and the county school fund primarily, some other little sources, not changed a whole lot over this time period. You can see the growth in the beginning balance. As total funding has increased, the amount that's needed for the beginning balance has also changed. And then the top part is the bonds, which you can see have changed quite differently from year to year, depending on what the school districts are asking the voters to approve in the way of new bonds.
Steve?
Yes. I know it's not audited, but if we were to go out to the current year, could you give us a sense of what those, particularly the state bar, might look like, and also the beginning balance? Would we see a smaller beginning balance number?
Well, for 02-03, you'll see the state bar shrink a little bit. For 03-04, I think you'll see the beginning balance drop. So it depends on which year you're talking about.
Oh. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Brunner.
Thank you. Steve, what does the beginning balance number include? And I guess what I'm thinking about is, does it include funds that are dedicated for particular purposes?
Representative Barnhart, yes. It includes beginning balances for all the funds, whether it's capital, general funds, special funds, federal funds, whatever. It's everything here.
Will there be a breakdown of this later?
No.
Okay. Is that generatable, or is that a difficult thing to do?
It can be done. If you want a beginning balance by fund, I think it's doable.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The reason I'm asking this is because that number is a pretty big number, and I think it's misleading because it.
If you're talking about the operating.
If you're talking about operating funds, I think they're a whole lot smaller than that, and I think that somebody just looking at this slide is going to see that number and think, boy, look at all that money they've got, and yet I think most of it is dedicated for particular things in the capital funds it doesn't regenerate.
Correct.
Intuitively, I'm going to say that's likely true. It'd be interesting to know, Steve.
It's capital funds, and it also may be related to the 25% state payment being in May just before the close of the school year, and that state payment has grown.
So it's a timing issue, too.
Yeah. Timing issue as well.
Okay.
So probably a combination of those and some other changes. What is this money being spent for? There's a couple of different ways of looking at this. I've divided up between instruction and support, and then categories of salary and benefits and services and materials and capital within those two. If you put the instruction salary and benefits of 47% with the salary and benefits under support of the 25%, you get 72% for salary and benefits, and the remainder then for services and materials and capital. But if you just look at instruction by itself, you have the 47 plus the percent plus the 6% for services and materials and 1% for capital. So that is a little bit about 54%. So depends on which way you want to look at it, whether you want to look at it as instruction versus support or salary and benefits versus everything else, what that looks out to be. In the support side, for that salary and benefits, you have like the social workers, the health workers, all of the administrators, the transportation, bus drivers, the food service people, operations and maintenance, guidance, attendance, all of that kind of staff support to operate the school.
But for districts, say, that contract out bus services with that wouldn't come under support salary. I assume that'd come under support services?
I think that would be under support services, yes. Yeah, so it makes a difference in terms of how the district offers the services. Okay, now let's look at the 0103 binding numbers just briefly. State school fund, starting out with state school fund, just to go back to what Measure 5 did, you're aware of that. But also to point out that the Oregon Constitution has not changed during this process. So the Constitution still requires a uniform and general system of schools. There's been some challenges, but none have been successful relative to this language in the Oregon Constitution.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I've been wondering about this for some time as we hear this discussion about Portland and the Portland area setting up a regional funding system of their schools. How can they do that given this constitutional rule?
That's a legal question.
No, it's a legal question.
I don't think I can answer. It depends on probably how much leeway there would be to have different funding levels by district. Before the equalization formula, there was a wide range of funding per student among the districts. And at that time, that was okay under the Constitution. So it just depends upon how you think the courts would currently interpret that language.
As I understand, in what Portland is proposing, it's a regional taxing authority that's not coming from the schools themselves. That is, it's a regional taxing authority from other local governments that are then transferring the funds to the school districts. Yeah, that raises a very interesting question. So that's not state action per se that would be resulting in that extra support. But achieves the same consequence, does it raise an issue? I don't know. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think at some point we do need that discussion because I think there are also some federal challenges to inequities in that. So I think it is important to take a look at that at some point and see what possibilities are out there.
Well, if as we develop some of these, there are going to be questions, I think, you also, if we approach local option, in terms of what, to what extent does the Constitution limit some divergence among districts. We will probably get to a point where we'll ask some questions, specific questions of legislative council, and get some guidance on these, on these particular issues.
For the 0103 biennium, the state school fund comes from different sources. Primarily, it's general fund at 80%, lottery at 8%, and another at about 12%. So, as during the special sessions, the general fund portion tends to decrease, and the other fund sources tended to increase that was put into the state school fund. Under the other category, you have the MUPL money. Don't ask me to explain what that is. You have some of the tobacco settlement money and so on that's been transferred, will be transferred into the state school fund. So the general fund portion has dropped from prior biennials. For this biennium, there's been a transition, and I have several slides just to kind of walk you through that. And I really hesitate to give you any percentages because it depends upon what you compare that drives those percentage numbers. You can do the comparison to close of session to what we think it is now. You can do it from year to year, which gives you a different percentage change. You can do it with and without the school improvement fund. You can do it with or without other accrual dollars. And so there's so many different ways to look at this. It's hard to know what the percent represents unless you really understand what it's measuring. And so I didn't put any on here. But the state school fund, at close of regular session, was about $2.54 billion for 0203. Now it's down to about $2.15 billion. That assumes that Measure 28 does not pass. And it also assumes the across-the-board cuts that are made.
So that's current law.
So current law, kind of hopefully worst-case scenario until the March forecast. Okay, so the state school fund has decreased. What often isn't talked about is the local revenue side of it. There's been some adjustments in that number, too, since the close of the regular session, but not a substantial change. It's dropped a little bit. But helping minimize that drop transfer of the common school fund, $17.7 million, I think it was, and that counts as local revenue. So that kind of masks the change in the property taxes. The drop in the property tax estimates during the biennium. But not too much. So that again goes back to the stability of the property tax system and the revenue from that source. Then, but that hasn't changed too much. So if you put state and local together, then you don't have as much of a percentage change, no matter how you measure it, as you do just by the state by state school fund by itself. But you can also include then, as I have on this slide, the school improvement funds of going from $108 million in 0102 to zero in 0203. So that needs to be taken into account as well. Looking at it on a per weighted student basis, and we'll later get to defining what ADMW is, but for those of you who are familiar with that term and it's used in the formula, you can see some numbers here where the current estimates, this is both K-12 and ESD, not just K-12 school districts, it's from about 5350 per weighted student to 4935, again without any school improvement funds. So that's kind of where we're at. And if you hear percentages, try to know whether it's per student, whether it's total dollars, whether it's just K-12, K-12 ESD, whether it includes improvement, doesn't include, and so on. So,
well, and I think, too, we heard from the ECO Northwest study that we got to, that was presented to the
school funding, the revenue option task force. It also depends whether you're measuring student population as of, you know, opening day of school, or whether you're counting just per head, whether you're doing the EDMW, whether you count it later in the year. I mean, you can come up with all sorts of different percentages depending on where you measure your population.
That's right. And how. And you can come to different conclusions depending on which of those measures you use. Okay, the state school fund, as appropriated for 0103, included money for other sources other than just the formula for K-12 and ESDs. $400,000 per year goes to fund disabled out-of-state school placement, and there's typically been three or four students, I think maybe as high as five one year, that are funded from that source. Small high schools, there was $9 million set aside for giving $200 per student to small high schools. And there was also the beginning of funds for state special education. These are the hospital programs, the long-term care students in long-term care facilities, the deaf and blind school, et cetera, that was decided to fund those directly out of the state school fund rather than the county school fund. So this is money basically that comes off the top. Then what's left is split between K-12 school districts and ESDs, and then also a reminder that students that are in the Youth Corrections Education Program and Youth Detention Education Programs are included in those formula student counts and funded out of the state school fund dollars. On the local revenue side, it's primarily property taxes for operations. There's no bond property taxes included in the formula local revenue. And it's taxes collected, not taxes imposed. So it depends upon the payment. What percent of the taxes are actually paid to the school districts that is used in the formula. So if collections go up or down, that affects that number a little bit. And that's one of the things that we've had to adjust for during this biennium, with the expectation that the collections or the payments will drop a little bit. Then the common school fund money is included, the county school fund, or the federal force revenue that's payment that's related to what used to be the federal timber harvest revenue. The state-managed county trust forest, that's the primarily from the Tillamook Forest Funds. The Grant and Wallawa are two ESDs that still are under the old equalization laws, where they levy property tax dollars ESD-wide and then share them with the school districts within their ESDs. And then there's a very small...
Representative Berger has a question.
I have a question about the federal forest revenue. The bill was passed through the federal government for economically deprived communities, if that went into the formula, didn't it?
Yes, it did. All of that increase was included in the formula, in the federal forest revenue dollars in the formula.
So this doesn't refer to that?
Yes, it does.
It does refer
yes,
to that.
Yes, it does.
All right.
Well, you say it went into the formula. It went in as local revenue. It didn't go into the state school fund, but it went in as local revenue, so it results in an offset for those districts then from the state school fund.
All of the local revenue...
It is. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All of the local revenue listed here stays with the district.
Okay.
Doesn't pass through the state school fund.
Okay.
But it is reflected. It's taken into account in the distribution from the state school fund.
Right.
And offsets are made.
Correct.
According to the local revenue.
So am I understanding then the higher the revenue, local revenue, that has a negative effect on the state revenue?
Right. The formula will say the state and local revenue should be this much. If property taxes are high relative to that formula amount, then the state dollars are small.
Property taxes or any other of these sources.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's how we achieve equalization.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to the detail of that process as we proceed. It's also too important, I think, to notice here what isn't included as local revenue. Okay. So any gifts, grants, donations, federal dollars are excluded in this process, interest earnings. If the school district sells some land, that's not included. So it's just these sources and nothing else that are part of formula revenue. For the current biennium, if you include both state and local, you get this kind of distribution, with about the formula dollars being a little over about $3.3 billion in 01-02, about $3.1 billion in 02-03, and then education service districts dropping from about $156 million to $143 million. That's currently where we're at. Those numbers may change, especially the 02-03, and then, of course, the 01-02 are still estimates because we don't have complete or final local revenue numbers.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the increase in special ed funding due to increased federal money flowing through?
No, the state special education dollars here are for those hospital programs that are now funded directly out of the state school fund. So it's just those three, the long-term care of the hospital, the state school for the deaf and blind.
Representative Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question about that. I'm Corporation XYZ, and I'm going to make a large contribution to the school. Does it necessarily come into any of these revenues, or is
it not?
It does not.
It does not.
So
it's a donation. It's not included as local revenue for the formula purposes.
All right. Thank you.
So all of those donation types funds are outside the formula. I think the reason they're not part of the formula because they're voluntary payments. And if there were voluntary payments included in the formula, it's likely that they wouldn't be made because they would end up being shared statewide in effect through the formula.
So school districts that establish foundations, for instance, that foundation money, that's all out of the formula.
All outside.
Yeah.
Okay, if we just look at it in a chart form, the state school fund is about 68%, property taxes 29%, and other local 3%. You'll hear for the last several years that the state school fund has been about 70% and local revenue about 30%. That the state school fund portion is dropping a little bit in this chart because of the reduction in the state school fund for 02-03. So that's why you get a little bit different split than what we're used to telling you about 70-30. Okay, I also just want to mention that last session there was a total revenue cap continued. I think it started in with the 97 session that put an overall cap on state and local formula revenue for school districts and ESDs such that just the estimate for local revenue was way off, was way low, and it came up to be much, much higher, that then the state and local dollars would bump against this cap and the state dollars could drop to offset the additional local revenue. That was put in there, started in 97 primarily because we had a new property tax system. We didn't know how accurate our estimates were going to be, and there was a concern that they might be weighed low and that school districts would have much more money than the legislature intended for them to have it in effect. And so the cap process was started. It's continued. It's in effect here. But, of course, it's moot at this stage.
We're looking up at the cap.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's move into the formula. When it was adopted back in the 91 session, there were some distribution principles that were agreed to kind of guide how the formula was put together. Basically, it was agreed that state school funding, or all of the sources, all the operating revenue sources statewide should be included in the formula. And that was pretty much done. It says all. There's some exceptions, but it's fairly broad in terms of what those general operating revenue sources are that are included. The second was to let each district decide how to spend its money. The legislature wouldn't be involved in micromanaging how much school districts could spend for this or that, so that the state aid was then given in a lump sum amount rather than in categorical grants. Third, to basically adjust funding only for uncontrollable cost differences. And we'll get into what's included in the fund in terms of uncontrollable cost differences, but for example, transportation costs. The school district has no control over where the students live, what the density of those students are, how far they are from the school, and how much it's going to cost to transport them to school. So basically, the intent was to try to justify any revenue differences in a rational manner if they were included in the formula, and to include what is considered, I think, the most important sources of cost differences. And then fourthly, to try to avoid incentives for school districts to try to increase their allocation. And the process basically was, well, the fewer classifications we have, and if we set any limits within those classifications, that will minimize any game playing or incentives for districts to try to increase their allocation at the expense of other districts. So those are the guidelines. The general format then for the formula was to say that state and local revenue equals basically a student-driven payment with some adjustments, starting with the base level, making adjustments to that base level using various cost factors. So that's the broad outline, and then we'll put in the details as we go along. The cost factors for the student weights that we'll define, a factor for teacher experience, because your experience level of your teachers, in effect, drives some of your costs, the transportation costs that we've mentioned, and then in 99, there was the cost factor for new facilities that were added, and we'll get into the detail for each of those. Basically, the formula says that state and local revenue equals the general purpose grant, transportation grant, and facility grant to deal with those cost factors. So there's three components, and we'll deal with each of those in turn. But I just wanted to get up front that it's divided into these three pots in terms of where the money comes from for the school district from the formula. The general purpose grant is kind of the more complex, and to get to that final calculation, we want to look at first how we measure students. There's several measures here, and a couple that we've mentioned that aren't here. One is not mentioned here is enrollment. Fall enrollment tends to be the higher count. Average daily membership then is how many students are enrolled on average over the school year. So if you have those that drop out, that will tend to decrease your average daily membership over the year. ADMR for resident students has kindergarten weighted at 1/2. ADMW is ADMR adjusted by student cost weights, and we'll list each of those weights. And then finally, in the formula, it uses extended ADMW, which is the higher of the current year or the prior year ADMW. So it helps to know which one of those we're talking about. Most people will say ADMW, meaning extended ADMW, and I do that myself, right? Because that's what's used in the formula. We just assume that it's understood that it's extended ADMW in that process.
Steve, here's my chance to ask the question I've wondered about for four sessions. ADMW, that's easy. The W stands for weight. ADMR, why does R stand for kindergarten?
R does not stand for kindergarten. R stands for resident.
Okay. Student.
But it's defined with kindergarten at half weight. Okay, here is the list then of the student weights related to special education and at-risk students. We have the individual education program has a total weight of 2 or an extra weight of 1. Students in poverty count an extra weight of 1/4 or a total weight of 1.25, English as a second language, 1.5, etc. For the individual education program, we have one of the limits that we mentioned as being 11% of ADM. So even though you have 13% of your students being eligible for individual education programs, only 11% can count for the total weight unless the district applies for a waiver from the Department of Education to exceed that 11% cap. So they have to go through that process, it's reviewed, and then there's a certain amount of those that are approved of 11% for each of the districts that apply. Some of these weights are with individual students, the students in English as a second language and an individual education program identify specific students for those weights. Students in poverty, that's a census count of students, so it's a group weight. The pregnant and parenting and the others come from Department of Human Services, so again, it's a group weight, not an identity to a specific student. These are the numbers of students that are in these categories for special education and at-risk students. Special education being about 70-some thousand. English as a second language, a little over 50,000. Almost 80,000 in the poverty, and then small amounts in the other categories. So this gives you some idea of where the students are that qualify for the weights. And then if we look at the funds associated with those students, if we assume that the regular student is being funded at $5,000, then special education at a double weight is funded at $10,000. English as a second language at a half weight is at $7,500, and so on. So that gives you some credit then for the dollars that those students bring to the school district. But there's no requirement that those dollars be spent on those particular students. That's controlled by the school district itself. Now, besides those weights, there's also weights associated with grade level or grades in schools. There's still a few elementary and Union High School districts in Harney County. Everywhere else, the district is a unified K-12 district. But for those few districts, the elementary students are weighted at 0.9, the high school at 1.2. When you combine that, it gives you an average weight of 1 for the 1 through 12 grades. Kindergarten, we talked about at 1.5. Then we have the remote small schools. It's called the special correction factor. That varies by grade level, by number of students, and by distance to the nearest school, whether it's elementary or high school. And then that has been changed for the high schools. There's a phase-in process for small high schools where distance is no longer a factor in how much the weight is. And I think there's a table then that will help clarify that in terms of how that's calculated for the small schools. This is a chart for a remote small high school, remote meaning 20 miles or more to the next nearest high school, 4 grades. What you have then in the area between the two lines is the extra weight. So if you have a school on the bottom line of, say, 180 students, draw a vertical line straight up. On the ADM line, that should be at 180. And then the difference between 180 and whatever crosses on the weighted ADM line, something over 250, that difference would be the weighted students that are added for that small high school. Now, for the change that's occurring is that there used to be a category, and still is during this phase-in time period, of a partially remote small high school, such that if it was between 10 and 20 miles, it didn't get the full extra weight, it only got a portion of that extra weight. That's being phased out. Also being phased out is that if the high school was within 10 miles of another high school, it didn't get anything because it wasn't remote. But under the new law, it will just be a small high school, it will qualify, it will get the extra weight. So that's the change that's being phased in. For 0305, the phase-in will be 75% of that difference. After that, 100%, and it will. The mileage will no longer be a factor for high schools, but it still is for elementary schools. In terms of how much of that extra weight they get depends upon on the distance if they're within a certain range.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How many students are we talking about here? What percentage of the student population?
Oh, it's a small percentage. I think I have a slide later on that has something on that. Trying to think, it's 60, as I recall, it was 60-some school districts. It's more schools than that. I don't know what the student count is. The weight is, the added weight is a little over 2,000. I think about 2,600 beginning in 03, 04. But then it's a small number of extra students.
That's the added weight.
The added weight, yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The policy thinking here is that if you are a remote school, transportation costs are higher.
If you're a small school, yes, the cost per student is higher to try to provide, but not transportation. That's taken care of in the transportation.
That's what I thought.
But you need, you have fewer students per teacher, for example. If you only have 10 students in this small school, you still need a teacher. And so that drives the cost per student higher.
I think, it was designed, I think, to recognize, take into account probably the higher overhead, the fixed cost that you have in the small schools that you can't spread across a larger student population.
Okay, and this gives you a little bit of a feel for the change. It's limited to districts under 8,500 ADMW. And as I said, it increases the weight if it's less than 20 miles, and we're currently at about 75% starting next year. Okay, now, having gone through the weights, this is basically a comparison of ADM to ADMW over the time period. You can see that ADM has grown more slowly. ADMW has grown faster, one, because of the number of students in special education, and especially English as a second language, has grown rather dramatically. It's not unusual to have a 10 or 15% increase in the number of students counted as English as a second language, or English language learners, I think was maybe the new terminology for that. And also contributing to the additional growth in ADMW is a change in the definition, adding those students in youth correction programs or youth detention programs, and adding the extra weights for the small high schools. So it's both a combination of a little bit of the change in the definition, but also the growth in special education students.
Representative Virgin.
I'm sure there's a process, but I just don't know about it. How do you verify numbers, for instance, with ESD, let's say autism or some special needs? Who actually verifies that those are the numbers of students? Is it each local ESD or?
For the each school district reports numbers to the Department of Education. And I don't know exactly what the process is for the department
to verify.
Checking back and verifying with this.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, then the next part of the general purpose grant calculation is a student or a teacher experience factor. It relates to the district average experience in years compared to the state average experience level for all teachers. Currently it's 13 and a half years, the average. If the district is 1 year above that average, it adds $25 per weighted student. If it's, for example, 1 year below that average, it subtracts $25 per weighted student. And that, again, is to adjust for the difference in salary levels based on years of experience.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, do you know approximately how many districts to which that is applied?
Applies to all districts.
But some aren't eligible. Follow-up, please. Some aren't eligible because they don't have that additional experience. How many take advantage of this?
Where
it's a benefit to them?
But I don't know that any is at the average, and then would be zero.
But I think your point is some are below the average.
Some are above.
Somebody should be at the average.
Well, very close to it. But basically, those that are above the average gain a little bit. Those that are below the average lose a little bit. The net effect from the teacher experience factor is basically almost zero. So it's just a factor that shifts money around based on that experience level. Okay, now we're ready to define the general purpose grant, so it's ADMW extended times a $4,500 target amount that's adjusted by the teacher experience factor. The $4,500 is an arbitrary number that was picked back in 91, hasn't been changed since then. And then there's a balance ratio or balance factor to distribute all of the funds that are available. That currently is at over 100% back in 91. I think it was at about a 90% level of the adjusted targeted amount would be the funds available within the state and local dollars as they were at that time. Okay, so that's the general purpose grant calculation. Now we want to move on to the transportation grant. Basically, it's transportation costs for moving students between from home to school and school to home. But there's a few other categories that will come into play as approved transportation costs. The transportation grant itself is 70% of those approved transportation costs. So it's basically a reimbursement process.
At 70%. And again, the rationale for 70%?
Probably to as an incentive for some efficiency. If the district can reduce its transportation cost $1, it gets to keep 30 cents in effect. And if costs go up, it has to come up with the 30 cents. That's not included in the formula. The transportation dollars have gone up fairly fast in the mid-90s, tends to be tapering off a little bit now. It's about $186 million overall, with 70% included in the formula at about $130 million. The average per weighted student is about $283 for transportation. Okay, so we now have the transportation grant. The facility cost for the facility grant is basically for adding new classroom space, whether it's new construction, additions, or portables. That doesn't matter, but it also doesn't include any land costs for the addition of that classroom space. As it was first adopted, it was considered to be about 8% of those construction costs, the 8% being the amount that was thought would cover the costs that could not be bonded for that new structure or new addition. In 97, I think it was in Measure 47, that there were restrictions on what could be bonded. And the furniture, the equipment inside the classroom that wasn't part of the structure could not be bonded, and so this was to help out with those costs.
Mr. Chair, the policy decision here is related to if you're a fast-growing district, you need to help in that way?
It was primarily, yes, to help fast-growing districts that were adding new schools or classroom space. Mm. It was capped at $17.5 million per biennium, not per year. And it's first paid in the year when the facility is opened up and used as a classroom. You can see here that it varies, can vary quite a bit, especially in 01, 02, 02, 03, how that $17.5 million is split up from year to year. Only $5 million in 01, 02, 02, 03, $12.5 million approximately. So that can cause some shifts in terms of if the facility grant is taking more money in this year, then there's a little bit less money available for general purpose grants. Or if it's not taking as much, close to half, like in 01, 02, then there's a little bit more money available for general purpose grants.
And this slide illustrates the impact of that $17.5 million cap on the 8%, on the 8% cap as well. I mean,
yes.
By limiting those dollar amounts, we've limited the percentage to actually 3%. Yeah.
Right. It's dropped down to what we think will be 3% now. So the $17.5 million hasn't been changed to accommodate what's come online for this biennium. What happens next biennium, it may go back up. But we don't have data on that yet, what that might look like. Okay, so now we're back to this slide. We've defined each of the grants in turn. We want to look at a couple of examples here. Basically, if we want to put some shorthand calculation methods to the labels. We have students times the $4,500 and adjusted to teacher experience and total funds, 70% for transportation costs and up to 8% for construction costs. You can see the calculation down there. It looks relatively straightforward and simple, but there's a lot of information that has to be gathered that to back up these numbers.
So Steve, I think it's just worth, especially for new members who are seeing this for the first time, this has nothing to do with how big the pie is. This just this has to do is how the pie gets divided,
correct,
between districts. And so as you, because you begin to look at these factors, and it sounds like dollar amounts that are adding up and adding up and adding up, and really not. I mean, this is all just a matter of how we divide the pie among the constituent districts. So every additional weight that you add to this particular cost reduces the general purpose grant.
Correct. It's basically a zero sum game.
Yeah.
Once you set the state revenue level and you have a local revenue estimate, everything else is dividing up what's available.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, Steve, if you've heard and watched other states and seen the factor of the cost of doing business. For example, labor costs in Tillamook may be higher than the labor costs in Coos Bay. And if that's ever an appropriate factor to put in a formula.
Well, going back to 91 when the formula was first put together, that was considered. Should there be some weight for some cost variations related to cost of living or salary levels or something like that? And at that time it was decided not to do it, but it was felt that that would be an addition within a few years.
It was
that would be another weight in the formula, but it just didn't happen.
How would you do that? Would you use a CPI or a labor index?
Well, there were different studies done and different approaches. I think one was to try to look at an index for a comparable professional people that would be comparable to teachers and school staff. Another was to look at some regional cost of living index. And so there are different ways to try to get at it. But it's not something you can really easily do this school district by school district. That's part of the problem of doing it at that small geographic area. But you could do it regionally. And then there was just always, well, how much would it cost to gather the information?
Mm-hmm. And to maintain it on a biennial basis.
Okay, just a few examples here to experiment with school districts A, B, and C. All have the same target level. They have different teacher experience levels relative to the state average, which increases or decreases that target level. And then here it shows 107% as the adjustment factor to available funds. That gives you an adjusted targeted amount per student, and then the transportation costs are added to that to arrive at the final number. So the differences, and these districts are assumed not to qualify for facility grants, so the differences per weighted student are usually fairly narrow, and we'll have a slide on that. But most of the differences comes in either on the transportation side or the facility grant, whether they qualify or don't qualify for facility grant that year, and then a little bit from the teacher experience factor. So it's those three that explain the differences per weighted student. But then you have different ratios of weighted students to total students to take into account if you look at it on an ADM basis rather than a weighted student basis. This points out how important the general purpose grant is to the total. It's over 95% of the total dollars, which means those weights are very important in calculating that general purpose grant for each district share, because so much money goes to the general purpose grant. Transportation is a little over 4%, and the facility grant less than 0.5%.
Something else about the weights, I guess, is important to keep in mind, too, is that going back to one of your earlier slides on the principles of the formulas, they're not categorical. They don't identify categorical spending. So we look at the weights in terms of calculating the general purpose grant, but districts are not required to spend
their money based on the weights from which their distribution is derived.
Correct.
Yeah.
As you get an extra half weight for English as a second language, you may or may not be spending that extra money on English as a second language cost.
That only determines how much the district gets in gross.
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, it's not micromanaging at the school district level.
Right.
On how the money is spent.
Because when we talk about the weights, it looks like categorical spending. You're determining dollars based on types of students within the district. So, again, just getting used to this, we use that to get to a number, but we don't actually require the schools to spend according to the calculation.
Yes. Okay, then this slide says when the state school fund is actually paid out to the school district. Once you've decided what their slice of the pie is, when do they get it? And it has the old and new. Before the special session change, it was 16 2/3% paid in August and 8 1/3 monthly payment through May and then 25% in May. That was changed then so that in July there would be basically a two-month payment in July, 16 2/3%, and then a monthly payment through May and June, May, and then no payment in June. So basically you get a double payment in July and no payment in June, monthly payments for the rest of the time, beginning with 2003-04 next year. Okay, the results of the formula, if you look again here at the total dollars, you can see how it's changed over this time period. There is a precedent for a decrease in the state school fund if you go back to 93-94, or overall revenue being available. It dropped that year. State was having some economic problems at that time too, and there wasn't as much money available for the state school fund. And then if you look at 97-98, you'll see the little white boxes at the top. That's not formula revenue, but it was additional revenue outside the formula that was pretty much divided up on a per-weighted student basis. Whether it was 97-98, it was the classroom needs. After that, it was bonded or lottery-backed school bond revenue for capital needs for the years, and then in 01-02 it's the school improvement funds, and then nothing for 02-03 because the school improvement fund went away. So that's what the kind of information that you have there and how that has changed in total dollars. On a per student basis, you get a picture of something like this. What's different here is that on an ADM level, it's increased a little bit faster than on an ADMW level. Right, that's because ADMW is growing faster than ADM. Right, so the growth in dollars using that measure grows a little bit slower. For funding equity for K-12, what I tell people when they ask me about, well, is the system equitable, I basically say if you're referring to the current formula, yes, that's the legislature's definition of equity in school funding. what results you get from the formula. And it applies to school districts. It's not an equity formula for outcomes or inputs or students. It gets at the school district level. And it's a policy choice of the legislature, and it has changed a little bit since it was adopted, and I'm sure it will change in the future. So basically, equity is a moving target, and it's what the legislature defines it to be. The results of the formula here then show you just how districts are clustered on revenue per student, how close they are around the average. There's not a large dispersion or a wide range between the high and the low. About a third are within $100 of the average on either side of it. there's about 12% that's over $100 to $200 above, and then you have 10% over the $5,300 and 12% under the $5,000. So a fairly narrow range on a per weighted student basis, because that's what the formula is using to distribute those dollars. And you don't get that much of deference from the transportation and the teacher experience factor in the facility grant on a per weighted student basis. So that's been the result of this equalization process and how that formula works. Now, unless there are questions on that process, I'm ready to move into education service districts and talk about the phase-in for their equalization. Just to go back a little bit in the way of history here, you've had a process of merging many of the ESDs. There's now 21 statewide. And if there's any other further merging of ESDs, that will be on a voluntary basis. There's nothing in the legislation that would require more merging of ESDs. Here you have the regions for ESDs, basically to get a feel of the territory for each of the 21 ESDs. From the names, you don't always know where they're at or how big they are geographically. So you can see that they're anywhere from one county size up to four counties. And this is county boundaries, and ESD boundaries follow county boundaries, but they're not exactly the same. The ESD boundaries will follow the school boundaries. The ESD has a few specific purposes listed in the statute, but basically they're to provide services both to the State Board of Education and to their component school districts, and also to assist in the coordination of some other local services, whether it's related to health or social services, employment training, whatever. So they have a fairly broad range of activities, and you'll find that ESDs have a wide range of services, and there's no very few services that you can say all ESDs provide. Because it just does vary all over the map. The biggest one, though, is special education support for their component school districts. They have the same funding sources as school districts, but most of it is state funds and local property tax revenue. Some ESDs generate a lot of revenue from contracts for services. If school districts want a specific service and they're willing to pay the ESD to provide it because the ESD can do it more efficiently, yes, we will arrange to do that based on a contract with the school districts that want that service. The funding is about $175 million for the biennium in state aid, a little over $125 million of local revenue. There's a small amount transferred to K-12, again from Grant and Wallawa ESD equalization funds going to the school districts, is shown as a negative here, and it doesn't include any contract service revenue, which can be a substantial amount for some ESDs. The ratio between property taxes and school fund for ESDs is a little bit different than for school districts. It's about a 60-40 split.
Representative Berger's question.
Is there anything that restricts these contracted services to only those districts within
ESD?
The ESD?
No, it could be across ESD boundaries.
Okay, so one ESD could be providing contracts or a service through contract to every district in the state? Theoretically.
That's right, I think so. Or to another ESD.
Okay.
There was nothing really written down in terms of the general logic for the way the equalization phase-in or final result was adopted last session, but it went a little bit something like this, that ESDs are providing services to school districts, that ESD costs then are related to school district costs, and we already have a K-12 formula in place. It has weights to adjust for those costs. So why not just not reinvent a new formula for ESDs? Why not just piggyback on the existing formula for school districts and make ESD revenue then a percent or proportional to the revenue, the formula revenue for their component school districts? So that's basically the thinking that led to the state and local revenue for each ESD being a percent of the district school district formula revenue for the component school districts or the member school districts within that ESD boundary. Now the phase-in process, though, to get to that point, distinguishes basically between high-funded ESDs and low-funded ESDs as the starting point. It sets a target, and then it defines a base for those low-funded ESDs, and then identifies a gap or the difference between that base and the target, and says we narrow that gap during the phase-in process until the base and the target are the same number. Right? And that was a five-year process. For the high-funded ESDs, it's just the opposite. The base or the existing revenue is above the target, and so the gap has to be narrowed and the base revenue decreased over that five-year period. The process of doing that is to make state and local revenue equal to the base revenue plus or minus a percent of the gap, and then compare that result to an overall minimum amount per district. So if you have an ESD, it's kind of like the small school correction factor. Once if ESD doesn't have many students, it's not generating much money from the number of students, then it has a certain minimum cost that it needs to run its ESD. And so that there was numbers for that, and I have a slide to show what those are. As part of the ESD equalization process, though, we need to step back, and you have to look at, well, how do you treat school districts fairly relative to ESDs once you have a total pot of money? What's fair for the K-12 share of that total, and what's fair for the ESD share? And it was basically agreed that K-12 should get 95% of that total and ESDs 5% when it was fully phased in. And this shows you the percentages during that phase-in process. And that was agreed to by both school districts and ESDs that was a fair split of both the local revenue for K-12, local revenue for ESDs, and the state school fund for both. So that's where it's headed. This shows you the percent for the ESDs, the percent of the component school district formula revenue that they get. Okay? So it shows you the phase up to the 5%, and then it's calculated as a percent of their component school district revenue, so that, like in 05-06, it shows the ESD getting 5.263% of their component school district revenue, because that component share is only 95%. And so 5.263% of 95% is 5%. So that's the process of getting that split in place. So the Department of Education would use, say, the 95% for the formula, run it through the formula, get the district amounts, added those districts up by ESD, and then take the 5.263% of that total. That's the process. The base during the phase-in period is higher of the prior year revenue per student times the current year students, or prior year dollars, whichever is the higher. So that base changes each year as the gap is narrowed. The gap is narrowed according to these percentages for the high-funded ESDs. And it's set up to take 20% of the gap away in each of the 5 years. This makes it look different, but what's going on here is that the base changes each year, so the percentage of that of the gap changes. So in 01-02, or excuse me, yeah, 0102, it was 20% reduction for the high funded ESDs. That brought them down to 80%, so now you take 25% of the 80% or another 20%, et cetera, a third of 60%, half of 40% in that process. Okay. And how fast the base is brought down to the target in narrowing that gap over the phase-in period. For the low-funded ESDs, there's no specific percentage. It floats with whatever funds are available. And so that was the risk that the low-funded ESDs were willing to take on, because it wasn't anticipated that there would be any reduction in the state school fund. Okay. At that time. And also what's happened is that when, if you recall, I can't remember which special session it was now, when the school districts lost their school improvement funds in 02-03, the SD said, well, we don't get school improvement funds, but we'll help out school districts by shifting $4 million of our state school fund dollars to school districts. But through this process, since the state school fund has decreased, the target for ESDs has dropped as well. So you don't need as a higher percentage to get the low-funded ESDs narrowing that gap towards the target. So you have both changing, and where that's going to end up, just not sure yet. But it should be, probably will be in the 25-30% range. I haven't looked at those numbers recently, but that's kind of where it is for first initially narrowing the gap for the low point of the ESDs and bringing their base up. The minimum amounts were set to phase up according to this schedule, being $1 million in 05-06. Currently, only one ESD qualifies. That's Lake ESD. Lake ESD has something around 2,000 weighted students. So if it stays at about that level in 05-06 with $1 million, they'll have roughly $400 per weighted student. So they'll be above the target or above the percentage amount by $100 or $200 per weighted student. But again, it was felt that there was a minimum amount needed for that ESD to provide the kinds of services and fixed costs that it would have to operate. Okay, so finally then, when all is said and done, the state and local revenue for each ESD will be 5.263% of the formula revenue for their component districts. ESD equity, then again, is as it was defined as a percent of that component district revenue. It applies to ESDs, not to students, not to services, not to ESD programs. And again, it's a policy choice and will probably change. And that's all I have on the ESD formula. Any questions before proceeding?
Questions? Representative Woodruff.
What happens if the ESD does not provide a mandated program based on a lack of revenue?
I'm trying to think. I can't think of any mandated programs that they have. They service the boundary board, for example. They have a few functions that are mandated like that. Most of their programs are on a resolution basis. The districts, the school districts, get together with ESD and say, we want you to provide these services, but they have to vote on those by resolution that has to pass by two-thirds of the districts that have at least half of the students in ESD. So the component school districts have a big voice in what services that ESD offers.
You know, I'm sure you're right. I just am certainly, somehow I have gotten the idea that many of their programs are mandated and that they would have no choice but to service those children and mainstream them into the school system.
But they provide a lot of special education programs.
They assist school districts in providing mandated services.
Yes.
Right.
Like that's the way it, what it comes
I guess maybe my question is not to you, and maybe it's to Mr. Chair, as to can school districts, based on not having revenue, not provide a service?
Probably the short answer would be no. Certainly, if you're talking about special ed, for instance, that's a federal mandate. Federal mandate, and even though the federal government has never attained its commitment to funding, no, there is no opt out based on lack of local funding to provide. Ozzie Rose has his hand up. Ozzie, why don't you come forward for a second, as long as we're on the subject?
Yeah, he knows.
Straighten me out, Ozzie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ozzie Rose, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and Representative Virtue, the most significant thing you're talking about, I suspect, is special ed. And if the ESD stopped providing the special ed services they're providing, the local district is the one that's responsible for doing it. They're now doing it for and in conjunction with whatever words you want to use to make it cheaper and work better. But if the ESD said, I don't have the money to do it, that yet the local districts have got to provide it. They're the ones that have the responsibility by law.
Okay, thank you very much for explaining that.
Which gets back to what I said, they assist the districts in providing the mandated services.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I got it.
Okay, just a few slides then on other funds, moving beyond the state school fund, school improvement fund. No slides on that since the money isn't there now. but we're going to talk a little bit about the education stability.
It's just there to acknowledge it.
Nice slide. Placeholder.
Just a little bit on the local option. Basically, all I want to mention on the stability fund is that, as you are aware, it's the voters changed it from an endowment fund to a stability fund, and approved the transfer of $150 million from that fund to the state school fund this May. That will leave an available balance in the stability fund of about $107 million as of July 1. And then there's a estimated deposit of $118 million in 03-05 from 18% of net lottery earnings.
I'm sorry, Steve, you go back. The available balance, $107, that includes the... Oregon Growth Account funds in the Stability Fund?
It does not.
So that 187 means available for the state school. Liquid, is that what you're talking about? Okay.
One more. Are any of the constitutional triggers likely to be triggered during this biennium?
You mean the coming biennium?
Yes. Thank you.
In 03-05, I'll let Paul respond to that.
Well, the triggers, there's really two that are most likely to come into play. One is two consecutive quarters of falling employment on an annual average basis within the 12-month period. We've had, over the last 12 months, we've basically been flat on employment. So if you were to look at that, and we don't know what it'll be for this latest quarter, but that's phasing out as a trigger now. It was clearly in play in 2001 in the first half of 2002, but now that's a lot more iffy. But what is certainly in play for this biennium is the requirement that the revenue forecast be 2% or more less than the close of session. And, of course, as you've seen, we're now about 16% below. So that one will definitely that trigger will be in place throughout this biennium.
But once we get to July 1, mm-hmm. that sets a new reference point for that particular target, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So we'll have a new close of session forecast. Mm-hmm. If the September forecast were then down by 2% or more, then that trigger would be in place again.
Yes. Okay.
Well, to make certain I understand, I think what you just said is that the triggers apply for a biennium, As of midnight on June 30th, they expire and you start over again.
The trigger would be rebased when you would do a close of session forecast, and that close of session is done when the session ends. So you'll have a new forecast, but it's like the kicker. You'd have a new
date. Employment trigger. The
employment trigger is over a 12-month period, two quarters declining over a 12-month period.
Okay, so if on July 1 we looked back 12 months, that trigger could apply, perhaps.
It could, but it doesn't look like it. It's not predicted to at this point.
We certainly hope it doesn't.
We hope it doesn't, yes.
Thank you.
So it might not be raining in July.
That's correct.
It, next is the local option property tax adopted in 1999. Seems to be some interest in the local options. Go through a few slides here. It does require voter approval, and it's limited to the gap between major 5 and major 50. It's restricted to 5 years if it's for operating purposes and 10 years if it's for capital. And it can either be a dollar amount or a tax rate amount that the voters approve. This just shows you how the gap is measured. It's a tax gap, not a value gap. And you've had some property taxes already, so I'm not going to spend much time on that. But what I want to get to is how it relates to the formula. There's no limit on the amount of property taxes that can be raised within the gap on school districts. The limit comes that if the gap revenue raised is more than 10% of their school formula revenue or more than $500 per weighted student, then that gap local revenue becomes formula revenue once it exceeds those limits. Once it exceeds that limit, there's no incentive for the district to exceed the limit because it becomes local revenue in the formula. It would reduce their state school fund dollars. And in effect, then those state school fund dollars would be spread statewide over all of the other school districts. So that's how the incentive is taken away to exceed those amounts per student or 10% of the formula revenue.
And Steve, I think the rationale, as I recall, there was to try to maintain some semblance of equity equalization so we don't get districts wildly out of proportion in their level of spending.
How much variation from that equalization amount can there be? And so this was a way of restricting what that is.
Do you know of the districts that have passed local options? Have any of them, or how many of them, have hit that limit?
I don't know offhand.
Just curious if there are
none that I'm aware of.
John Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, Pendleton School District was entitled to one of those equalization grants from.
That's not equalization. I'm asking in the local option itself, how many districts have been constrained by that $500 per student, 10% grant?
My apologies, Mr. Chair, I don't know that.
I'll be surprised if any were, the way these things have worked out. Okay. John, we'll come to that in a second.
This is just a chart of that kind of comparison. For most districts, it's the gap that controls, not the limits.
Okay.
But if that gap will likely increase over time, assuming that real market value increases faster than assessed value. And so for some districts, it will start exceeding the 10% of the $500. And if the state school fund increases much, the amount per weighted student in the formula is going to be more than $5,000. And so 10% is going to be more than $500. And so the $500 is going to be the controlling cap, probably next biennium, assuming that the gap is sufficient to raise the $500. Here's what's happened in the way of elections over the last two calendar years on local options.
Three were approved in 2001, two in 2002 for only a 19% passage rate. So they haven't been real successful just yet. Last session, the legislature passed a way to equalize local option, thinking that, trying to make it a little bit easier for districts that have a low value per student to pass a local option. So if it's basically a property poor district, then if it has a tax rate, voters pass a tax rate, it doesn't raise a lot because of the low value, but the legislature basically said, well, we want that tax rate, that tax effort, to raise a certain minimum amount of property taxes. If it doesn't come from the district property taxpayers, the state will make that difference up. And the way to go about that was to calculate a target amount as an assessed value per student at the 75th percentile. So the assessed value for each school district is divided by their weighted ADM. In this situation, an amount per ADM is been arrived at, and the districts are ranked from highest to lowest, I guess. The lower 75% of those districts are eligible for an equalization grant. The top 25% are not. Okay, so that's where the target is set, at that assessed value of that 75th district. The grant then is calculated as though the district had that much assessed value per student at the target level. So the grant then is the ADM times the tax rate that's approved by the voters, or the equivalent if it's on a dollar levy, times the target assessed value per student minus the district value. Assessed value for students.
So when you say there's proportional reduction of insufficient funds, you mean if there's insufficient funds in the equalization fund and
correct.
You have more schools pass local options that are entitled than there are funds available, then you reduce that on a pro rata basis.
Correct. But it was also set so that if a school district passed a local option during the biennium, that they wouldn't qualify for any equalization until the next biennium. The thinking was that we wanted to know the number of districts that qualified before setting the appropriation level. And we didn't want new approvals during a biennium, basically diluting the funds available. So that was the approach to handle that kind of potential problem. So that hopefully there wouldn't be a need to have a proportional reduction. Okay, there during this biennium, there's 14 districts that have a local option. There may be a couple, two or three new ones this next biennium that qualify or that have a local option. Of those 14, only three qualified for equalization.
How many districts with a local option?
14.
But that's not as many as you showed on the slide where you were giving us the number of the pass-fail rate.
No, but that was just new ones.
Okay.
That had passed in
2002. Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
Right, there were some that passed before that.
Okay.
So there are 14 currently.
Okay.
That potentially qualify.
Yes.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. But three
qualify for equalization.
Pendleton and who else?
Colton and Camas Valley. So most of those that have passed the local option are above the target, have
right.
a higher assessed value for weighted per student per year. And of the new ones that have passed, I don't know where they're at, whether they're above or will be above or below the target.
Did those three that qualify pass during the current biennium, so they'll be drawing out in the coming biennium?
I don't know how long they passed their local option for, whether it was 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. I'd have to look at that. Whether those three will still qualify in those field five or not. Probably will. Okay, any questions on local option? All right. Then looking at
forward to the 0305 biennium, just the numbers that are in the governor's balanced budget. Currently, we have a little over $5 billion in the state school fund, and $550,000 set aside for local option equalization. And nothing in the school improvement fund, nothing for the out-of-state disability fund, that $400,000 a year ends up being set aside in the budget numbers. Nothing for the $200 for the small high schools. So it's just what's has to come out of the state school fund and the local option equalization. Dividing that up and including local revenues, you have about $7.3 billion for school districts and ESDs for the next biennium. What is different in these numbers is that the amount state plus or local plus state is about the same for each of the years. In the past, the pattern has been to show some growth in that total each year of the biennium. But here it's about $3.66 billion both years. So once it will become a little bit clear here what's going on, if we just split that up now between school districts and ESDs, we have local revenue increasing between the 2 years, a little over $1 billion each year. But the state school fund in 03-04 is set at about will be at about $2.4 billion as it was calculated in the governor's budget, and then would drop down to a little less than that in 04-05, offsetting the increase in local revenue, so that the combined total is about the same at $3.47 billion. So basically, if all of the growth is in the first year, then for the ESD share of that, again, about the same amount both years. Local revenue going up, second year state school fund going down, for a total of about $336 million biennium. This also points out that for school districts, we're talking about billions. For ESDs, we're talking about hundreds of millions. That shows you the difference between that 95%, 5% split. But that's the way it has been.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, is there some analysis going on about the revenue in the governor's budget? In other words, to verify that those revenues are projected revenues are right.
And local revenue, for instance.
Yeah.
Steve, do you want to follow?
Representative Berger, there was a executive order that was issued by Governor Kitzhaber following the following the 99 session, actually, and what that did was establish a school forecasting committee. Steve participates on that, and we've worked with the property tax numbers, and they produce a set of estimates on what the weighted student counts would be, projected enrollment growth, working with the state economist's office. And those are the numbers that are the basis for this. We will review those, get that group back together, and review that for any modifications for your legislatively adopted budget in May. So we'll review and update those local revenue numbers pending on new data we get between now and May.
Okay, a final slide. If there is no legislative action, this assumes, of course, that there will be legislative action to fund the state school fund. The ESD phase-in will continue. The small high school distance phase-in or phase-out, depending on how you want to look at it, will continue. There won't be any change in the student wage. There wouldn't be any change in what's included in local revenue. There wouldn't be any new monies transferred into the out-of-state placement funds. There wouldn't be any $200 plus per student for small high schools, and no school improvement funds. So it takes legislation to do these sorts of things. Also, let me just mention that there are a couple of research reports available if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of the distribution formula and the process that's gone through to arrive at the allocation among the school districts of the funds that are available. There's one on that process, and then there's also one on the changes that were made last session. They're both available in the office.
Okay. Any wrap-up questions for Steve?
Yes,
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And wrap-up question, indeed, it is. I think, Steve, going back to when you started this presentation, you mentioned what I would call the manipulation of information and statistics based on the variables in that. And one that I think we've been inundated with is the cost per student, particularly in comparison with other states. We get a cost ranging from $10,000 a year down to $4,500. Is there some information out there that compares apples and apples so that we really do know the answer to that?
Representative Hobson, on Monday we will have a presentation on the Eco Northwest study, and will we have Secretary of State's auditor? It'll just be Eco Northwest.
Just Eco Northwest.
Eco Northwest. They tell pretty much the same story. The number's a little different. And that does get at that question. The one caveat about that, of course, is that it's all based on numbers about as current as 2000, maybe 2001. So the world has changed substantially since then, but at least tells you where we've been historically. And it gets at the numbers in such a way. We saw that in the revenue options and school funding group. It gets at the numbers so that you can meaningfully compare them against other states, so not only against our own history, but also where we stand against other states. But again, disappointing in that just as we finish that, just as we get that study, all the numbers have changed, and we're back to kind of groping in the dark. But it tells us at least where we've traveled for the past 10 years.
Thank you.
Yeah, it'd be good information.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, just to kind of follow up on that, there's been so much misinformation sort of generally about this topic that even out-of-date numbers that are accurate are better than no numbers.
Well, I think what you'll find in looking at the numbers is it may not necessarily be technically misinformation. It's just a question of what you are comparing against what.
Exactly.
How you're counting. So the numbers don't lie. and really, the numbers that you see reported all have a basis in fact. This report, I think, is interesting how you see where those numbers come from and what they actually measure and what they actually compare. With that, then, we are finished for today. And again, thank you, Steve. Tomorrow, again, we'll start 5 minutes after the close of the House floor session, which is at 8:30. And we'll have with us we'll have a report on the Revenue Options and Task Force Committee that just concluded final action on its report yesterday. And we'll have some of the members of the Citizens Advisory Committee that put in a lot of time and hours and miles during the past few months to get that report ready for the task force. And so look forward to hearing from them tomorrow. With that, our business is concluded, and we are adjourned.